the Pilot TV podcast this week, we join Orlando Bloom and Cara Delevingne in Victorian London for neo-noir fantasy Carnival Row, dive into Netflix's stab at fantasy favourite Dark Crystal, and discover just how you can tackle the final season of a long-running drama series when half of your cast has legged it in The Affair. I'm Terry White, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast. This is hopefully not your first clue that this week we are without our fearless, fire escape loving podcast host, James Dyer, who is living his very best life at D23 in Los Angeles. Well, once he actually got into the country, did
we
enjoy?
He hasn't been detained, has he, by the Border Patrol?
Not detained. I think it's very important to say yes. Not detained. Just got himself into a bit of a bind. And firstly, I think we were just saying this is the most James Dyer podcast in Pilot TV podcast history, which makes it all the more beautiful. But I am joined by two co-hosts today. All is not lost. To my right, actually, they're both to my right, but to my right, it's podcast regular, the nicest guy in TV, friend to the stars, giver of warmth and charm, and not in any way James's actual voice twin, no matter what James's mum says. Hello, James's mum. It's Boyd Hilton.
Thank you. To your extreme right. I am on the extreme right.
You are on my extreme right. Way in which you are the extreme right.
I'm no James Dyer. What a hero, though. I mean, just a minute. I know we're short of time, but just to bow down before his heroic behaviour at immigration.
Yes.
In LA.
For anyone who wasn't following this, go to James C. Dyer on Twitter, or, you know, read the Daily Mail or the Washington Post, and you will discover that James Dyer got something of a grilling by an overzealous border agent when he went into Los Angeles, which resulted in something of a viral situation. I mean, the viral social media.
Yeah. And an actual apology from the official thing, whatever they're called. Border agent, the people in charge. I mean, that is incredible. The whole thing is spectacular.
Yeah. I can't wait for him to come back so that we can ask him about. Yeah. We can grill him ourselves.
We will grill him.
Fully fledged leader of the resistance now, I think.
I mean, my timeline was full of Star Wars gifts, I have to say, which is appropriate. The only way he got himself out of this situation was to say that he was there just to do Star Wars. Now, you just heard him. You won't have heard him before unless you listen to the Empire podcast, because joining Boyd and myself today is actually James's protege, our innocent, our adorable, our full of light and joy and Lizzo-loving Empire's online staff writer, Ben Travis. Hello.
Well, actually, I think you'll find I'm going to do my best to fulfil the James Dyer role this week. There is so much sci-fi explaining to do.
Yeah.
So I'll do my best.
Well, I think about all of us have to take a share of the responsibility of being James. Mm-hmm. So you're going to do the sci-fi explaining.
I'll do the sci-fi explaining, yep.
Boyd?
I'm just going to be the bald, middle-class white guy in the room.
Thank God.
How about that?
Where would we get another one of those?
Right, it's a rare beast.
And I will call myself a bellend over and over again.
There you go. That'll
work. We will be good. Right. So let's jump straight in. What have we been watching this week, Boyd?
I have been watching one of those Netflix shows where I've been grumbling about this as you know, kind of first world problems and all of that. First world TV critic problems is that Netflix doesn't sometimes now, more and more it seems to me, does not give us advanced access to shows to review. Big shows, that happened with Mindhunter, and I thought the Mindhunter series was brilliant. I finished that now, that's phenomenal. 13 Reasons Why dropped on Friday, season 3, and I've watched pretty much all of it now, and I really liked it. And I say to Netflix, if you didn't let critics watch it, mate, you would have got more of a glow of approval for that for this third season, because the second season was terrible. It was a huge, big, kind of clunky, awkward, contrived attempt to retain what the magic of the first series. Mm. But the third series is really interesting and different and new. So whodunit, basically? Every single person in school could have killed Brian, who was the rapist, the serial rapist, who revealed to be so in the second series. It's done pretty effectively. There are some unfortunate things that you can't really go into for spoilers that I didn't like. But by and large, it's a really interesting look at pretty much every major issue in American schools and colleges right now, even up to including ICE, you know, ICE, the immigration people in America, there's a family who are kind of removed from their home at one point in the series. And I wasn't expecting that to be dealt with in 13 Reasons Why. It really feels very fresh and up to date. And just the whodunit element was very effective because it kept you guessing right to the end. This is an extraordinary kind of out there, very, very explicit, not explicit literally, but very bold attempts to deal with issues of sexuality and abuse and all of that. It's good. It's a really good show. It's definitely, it's a show that's definitely trying to get teenagers to watch it. And yeah, it is really extreme in terms of language and sex and violence and sexual violence sometimes. But I think it's kind of pretty effective in that sense, because I think young people will watch it and think, actually, this feels raw and visceral. And yet its messages are positive and good generally.
Because we'd previously been talking about it in comparison to Euphoria.
Right.
So where does this final... it's not the final season, right?
No, they've already...
It's the third. They've already
got another one coming, yeah.
Where does this kind of stack against Euphoria?
So it's nowhere near as good as... So Euphoria, I think, is an incredibly special, beautiful, brilliant, out there piece of kind of filmmaking on television. This, I don't think it's aspiring to... I think this is aspiring more of being a much more... mainstream proposition, even though it is daring and it's kind of doing stuff that in the Netflix world, in the kind of world of streaming and HBO, all of that, this is a much more mainstream proposition. I don't think it's trying to be as artistically challenging, if you like, as Euphoria is. But so it's kind of on that level, but I still think it works really well. It's possibly, you know, I'm not sure how many young people are ever going to watch Euphoria. Euphoria is one of those things that feels like it's a teen story, but actually for adults, whereas this feels like it's a teen story for teenagers. I would say that's the difference, probably. But it's still really good. I mean, it's still really well made. Everything on Netflix is kind of has a certain production value, but I don't think it's trying to be an incredibly cinematic, beautiful exploration of... But it has got, you know, there's two timelines, and one timeline is in full screen, bright, glowing colours, and the kind of current timeline, if you like, in the present day, is in muted tones, is in widescreen aspect ratio. It has little kind of inventive visual elements to it, but by and large, it's all about the story and the characters and dealing with the issues.
We've talked before about some of the problems with, especially the first season. Yeah. Does this go some way to redeem it?
It does. Yeah. I mean, they actually took out the scene where the central character took her own life recently. They've removed that from the whole series. And just generally, I think it's more careful in dealing with all of that. As I say, you can't kind of, unfortunately, everyone's seen it, there's a couple of things that I did have issues with. There's one character, I can kind of dance around a little bit by saying, there's one character who ends up actually falling for their abuser. And I think people have gone, oh, okay, hold on. But then I think the creator could probably defend it by saying that does happen. You know, that is a thing, that's a syndrome, that's a thing that could, but apart from that, there's kind of some incredibly bold, almost fantastic stuff in terms of about, there's a group that forms in the school about people who have been abused or sexually assaulted or raped. And that is really, I thought that was really, really well done. And I was checking the credits and all of those episodes that really deal with the crux of that are written by women, sometimes directed by women. So there's definitely, in terms of broadening out the creative team, I think they've done that quite effectively. It really makes a difference, I think.
It's strange that they haven't released the screeners, because it feels like at this sort of juncture, it was a show that needed a bit more positive press, and show that it has taken on board some of those criticisms over how they quite explicitly portray these really troubling issues for quite a young audience.
I agree. Maybe as a TV critic, we overplay our reports in these things, but I think so. I think it could have done with some, you know, positive. I mean, now all the reviews are coming out, people are being kind of nicer about it, but it's so much better than season two that I think it probably would have helped. But I think they're very sensitive about people writing about the way the show deals with all those things.
Ben Travis, have you been watching?
I haven't watched anything in a long time. I've moved house twice in the space of 2 months and have been without internet for such a long time. So I'm behind on like all my favourite shows. I still haven't seen Stranger Things 3, which is killing me. That's going to be my treat when our internet gets turned on. Finally watch Stranger Things 3.
Where are you living? Yeah. Like in a cave?
Yeah, I know. I feel like I've been in the dark ages. And obviously I've been able to stream stuff on my phone, but all of these amazing sort of big budget shows, I feel like I shouldn't watch that on my phone.
Yes.
But the one thing I have been watching, I slogged my way through The Umbrella Academy and didn't really enjoy it the whole time, but I just kind of felt like I should keep watching it, and I didn't mind watching that on my phone. I felt like I'm not enjoying this enough to save it for the big screen for my TV. And it kind of bugged me the whole way through, because I thought there was constantly like elements of promise, some really a couple of good characters, that quite hooky storyline that they already did in Heroes, where it's like at the start of the series, there's like the apocalypse is coming and that's going to happen at the end of the series and we've got to work out how we're going to get there and how we're going to stop it, which is, yeah, a very sort of grabby through line to a show, but it was way too long. Half of the characters were like ultra thin and it really did feel like it was using a lot of stylistic flourishes to paper over a lot of cracks. So I kind of kept watching out of a sense of duty, and also the Ellen Page storyline in it was the best thing in it. That kept me going the whole way through. But I have to say, even the finale didn't, it wasn't as satisfying as I wanted it to be. It did improve a bit in those final episodes, but it did seem a bit of a sort of Netflix, I don't know, condense it down, take out a couple of episodes, just tighten it up a bit. So I have to say, I probably won't watch the second season of that when it drops. But I'm about to get the internet back on. I can finally catch up with Stranger Things, with When They See Us, with Big Little Lies season 2 I haven't seen.
Ben, I'm behind on everything.
It's awful. Oh, I tell you what I did watch, though. I saw an incredible episode of The Chase. I love a quiz show.
Amazing. And, wow. Celebrity sort of, chase or normal chase?
Normal chase, but it was the most dramatic thing I've seen on TV this year.
Wow. Wow.
I'm not like going to go into the full rules of The Chase, but if you know how The Chase works, all of the team had been caught out except for one person who faced the chaser. Took the higher offer, single-handedly brought back £60,000 to the final round, and then single-handedly won the final chase and won themselves £60,000.
This is the contrast between you and James. James won't have heard of The Chase. He won't have any idea what it is, but I love the fact that you're picking The Chase as your dramatic highlight of the...
He is somewhere like losing his shit right now. He's probably on a plane trying to get back here before the end of the podcast to intervene, because he will also be unhappy with what I want to talk about this week, which is, I talked about it when the first episode aired, but the final episode of the Jade Goodie documentary on Channel 4 aired last week, and it was, I've now watched the third one 3 times. Did you watch it, Boyd?
Yep.
Oh my God. Yep. It was such a brilliant study of tabloid culture in the noughties, of class, essentially, of, you know, kind of the abuse that a lot of working class women got at that time, of that rise of populism, of that kind of celebrity. I just thought it was fascinating. It was so much more than you could have presumed it would be. It was so well done. The access they got was incredible. And that last episode was just devastating. I don't know about you, Boyd, but I just absolutely knocked me for six.
Yeah.
Like the kind of way that she kept kind of working right up until the end, doing anything and everything just to get money for her boys, clearly when she was in a lot of pain and was really towards the end of her life. But it was just, I just thought, brilliant, and just was such a brilliant deep dive on British culture at that specific time.
Yeah, to be reminded as well that she was on the Indian Big Brother told her about her illness, her cancer, it was incredible.
They didn't stop filming.
They didn't stop filming and all of that. And that she, and that one of her, which one, I can't remember which one it was, one of her long-term partners was saying, you know, she didn't know the difference between privacy. Jeff Brazier. I thought that was a really interesting point, because she clearly didn't, even though she was doing it to make money for her children and everything. But equally, she just had no kind of, she didn't have any boundary when it came to, and I think that's quite a modern day thing, even more so now, of course. This was before Instagram and all of that and social media. But you're right. I thought what really interesting, I think I might have watched it twice as well, was the talking heads, which, as you said, they had all the main players, if you like, from Davina and Dermot to the producer. Phil Edgar Jones was on it, who's kind of in charge of the whole thing. I bumped into him at the Edinburgh TV Festival and he was asking what I thought of it. And I thought he came across really well. Not all of the talking heads did, and it was like the talking heads were almost divided into those who thought this was going to be quite a kind of mainstream, you know, like, if I can say, Channel 5-ish type thing, with all due respect to Channel 5, you know, where they were going to have almost like have fun talking about this whole situation. And the ones like Phil Jones, who took it very seriously and was seriously analysing the situation. Yeah. And there was a real disconnect between those two sets of people. And some people just came across so badly in the talking heads element of it, just not really addressing the seriousness of the whole situation. I thought that was fascinating alone, let alone the whole story, which is incredible.
Yeah, because even Davina, who I think is amazing, there were moments when she was talking about, you know, starting to touch on how exploitative it was, but then it was kind of dismissed and they cut to some footage of Davina being like, welcome to Big Brother!
Yeah.
And it was just that kind of contrast.
Yeah.
And like you say, very few people actually came out of it very well, because you saw how she was kind of exploited to some extent, and what everybody else was getting out of it.
And as a snapshot of the time, like just being called a pig, you know, in the papers, it just, again, I mean, I know...
Talking of somebody who did not come across very well.
Yeah.
What was his name?
I'm not naming him.
Yeah, the unnameable tabloid TV columnist who called her a pig. And how did we ever, like, it's mad that that happened.
It's mad. That's what I kept thinking. Yeah. That time, obviously, you know, I work for Heat, and I think, you know, tons of things were written and said and all of that at the time that no one's particularly proud of, but the papers, I thought, were extraordinarily, terribly horrible and awful. And I think they're still capable of doing terrorism. I think we have moved on. I did come across thinking you couldn't get away with any of this now. Like, you know, it would be very, very different now. So I think that's at least something. I felt that.
The only thing I wondered is I found it fascinating how the kind of the racism and the language used by the girls in the hat against Shilpa Shetty was universally called out by the papers.
Yeah, that's true.
And we seem to be in such a weird grey area now where it's all about freedom of speech and being and the kind of acceptability of language.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
There's certain things you can imagine would actually be kind of like you'd have people in the papers now going, well, you know, it wasn't that bad.
That's true.
Find people on both sides.
Yeah. Brendan O'Neill in Spiked. Yeah. He would be like, oh, you know, let them have their say.
Yeah. Exactly.
This is the Metropolitan Media Elite. Yeah. But.
So that entire thing, three-parter, is on what I keep calling 4OD.
All four.
Why is it no longer 4OD?
It used to be 4OD, to be fair to you.
I think you just called it 4OD.
Yeah, 4OD. 4OD. But I mean, I'm going to make some noises and there will be words in there. Right, now it would be time for Funny or Dire. But almost as proof that having a segment that depends entirely on one member of the team being present in every single podcast until the end of time is a terrible idea, it's now not time for Funny or Dire. But you may remember that last week, James, kind of out of the blue, tabled the idea of killing Funny or Dire. And he did put it out to Twitter. Now, we will need to wait until next week to hear the results of this incredibly unscientific poll. But please do get in touch with James on Twitter to either give him a recommendation for a future Funny or Dire episode or to tell him whether you would like to keep or kill Funny or Dire. He is at James C. Dire. Please do it. He's very invested in this poll. Now, we're going to get to news because there has been an avalanche of news. Ben is adjusting his glasses.
He's getting into
geek mode. James isn't here because he is at Geek Heaven this weekend, otherwise known as D23, which is Disney's annual expo. Now, Ben, as mini James, would you like to start us off? Where would you like to start?
Begin? I mean, I think... we've got to start with the Mandalorian trailer, right? Mm. So this is the first ever live-action Star Wars TV show. Obviously, there have been the animated series in the past, like Clone Wars and I think Resistance is the current one. But this is the first fully-fledged live-action TV show set in that universe, set in the aftermath of Return of the Jedi. The showrunner is Jon Favreau, who obviously helped launch the MCU by directing Iron Man. He's working with Dave Filoni, who is entrenched in that Star Wars universe, having been the man behind those animated series. This show's been talked about for a long time. We've seen the cast come together. So you've got Pedro Pascal in the lead as a sort of outlaw gunslinger, bounty hunter. And we've got directors like, well, obviously Jon Favreau, but Taika Waititi and Bryce Dallas Howard on board. We've heard all these stories of coming together, of the show being made. And this is the first time we've actually seen some footage. And it's very exciting, and it looks pleasantly, kind of a bit more grown up.
Yeah,
I think the first thing you see is a stormtrooper helmet on a spike, and you're like, "Oh, okay, yeah, we are in the outer fringes of the galaxy. We're in sort of a lawless time in a lawless place after the fall of the Empire. Before things get to the point where there's a little bit more stability by the time you get to the Force Awakens. So, it seemed to be." Teasing a quite different arm of the Star Wars.
Well, I thought it was
universe.
Interesting they foregrounded Werner Herzog with the voiceover and everything. I thought that was an interesting choice. And for me, that was a brilliant choice because I was thinking, oh, this is exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just thought it looked just like a Star Wars movie, didn't it? That's what compared him to. It just looked so beautiful, beautifully made and everything. And I guess, why wouldn't it be? But that is exciting that you're going to get a serial drama on TV that looks and feels like an actual Star Wars movie on a weekly basis. And I just wanted to say the thing, I'm going to let you explain all the rest of this, but the really interesting announcement for me was that they're putting episodes out weekly and not in one go in the Netflix model, which I think is fascinating.
Do you think that's the right call?
I do, in a way, because I think Netflix have made that their USP and they're obsessed with it, even though, you know, when they acquire stuff, they still have to show it weekly. As you know, for example, The Good Place, which, you know, that'll be back soon, but that is weekly because they basically acquire it for internationally from NBC. So they have to stick with having that on a week. And that goes for a lot of their shows, but they kind of pretend that every single show they ever do is available to binge watch, but that's just not true. Whereas I think it makes sense to have that week. I think that Game of Thrones is the model for that Disney Plus is looking at, you know, create this global phenomenon of people watching week by week, and that thrill, that excitement of being able to talk about it on social media is a huge big thing for me, and more exciting than actually being able to binge on stuff. So I think it's a really interesting call.
Do you think you can the disconnect I always have is how you achieve that tuning in kind of appointment to view weekly thing with a streaming platform as opposed to a traditional linear TV? And I know it's maybe just a kind of whether it's a intellectual difference or a psychological difference, but I would never, I see Netflix, I see all streaming platforms as just something I can go and watch what I want when I want. I'm never in the habit of going a regular time regular place.
Yeah, I know what you mean,
How do you get over that?
I think really it's not seeing it as a particular boundary that, you know, it's all about that platform and that mode of watching stuff, i.e. streaming. For example, like, you know, I think I'm not sure what the actual stats are, but now possibly more people watch Sky's content on Now TV, which is their streaming service effectively, week by week. So for those people, they're just used to it. I think if you have Netflix and you're obsessed with using it as a thing where you watch your stuff all in one go in your own time, that's fine, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. I think you just kind of will deal with it, really.
I think a big part of that as well is Star Wars. Star Wars is an event. It will always be an event. And just like Monday was Game of Thrones Day, whatever day The Mandalorian comes out, people will know that's the day that the new episode comes out and the conversation will begin. I'm excited for it coming out weekly because to have that ongoing conversation over the space of a couple of months as these episodes are coming out, I think could be really valuable to this kind of show. As much as binging stuff on Netflix can be a really enjoyable viewing experience, it does sort of diminish the conversation around a show because everyone is at a different point.
Yes, of course.
Kind of watching through it. So I think it feels like quite a savvy move on Disney's part to, I think, make more of a splash about this.
I think the thing maybe closest to it is Star Trek Discovery is shown weekly on Netflix internationally. And I think that feels like a similar thing. That became, for Star Trek fans, that was a huge, they loved it. Shame James isn't here to discuss it. But that was definitely a weekly event in that world, massively.
Yes. Right, Obi-Wan Kenobi?
Obi-Wan Kenobi, this was rumoured last week, wasn't it?
Worst kept secret in recent history.
Yeah, so many things got sort of announced beforehand by all the various trade publications. And one of those obviously was, Obi-Wan series is coming to Disney+. It's been long rumoured that there would be a Ewan McGregor starring a film when they were doing the Star Wars story films, which seem to be sort of on hold for now. After we had Solo, it was very much thought that there would be an Obi-Wan equivalent, but I think it's going to work really nicely having this as a Disney Plus series. I wonder if they see the slightly diminished box office of something like Solo as indicating that there is still a huge audience out there for these stories, and people who love Star Wars are always going to be engaged in these bits of the like wider universe. But actually Disney Plus could be a really great space to cultivate those stories that maybe don't have as big of a sort of footprint when it comes to the big screen and huge audiences coming out of their homes to go and see that in the cinema. And they can tell those stories in a different way. I'm intrigued to see what this Obi-Wan story is going to be. Obviously, it's going to be set after Revenge of the Sith, post the prequel trilogy. Who knows, it'll be obviously before then the original trilogy as well, by which point you have Alec Guinness looking very old, and Ewan McGregor doesn't look that old yet, unless they do a Fargo on him and put him in prosthetics and things, but that would feel like a weird choice.
Now, there were a few other shows announced as well this weekend, and there was a little bit of a backlash, I'd say, about whether they should be cinematic properties or whether they should be on the small screen. So you had She-Hulk, you had Ms. Moon Knight and Ms. Marvel. Ms. Marvel in particular seemed to be the one that everybody was like, hang on, why is this not a big screen property.
Me included. And I really hope that this is a sort of, I'm not sure I should be saying this on the TV podcast, but I hope that this is a sort of launch pad for bringing Ms. Marvel into the sort of film universe in a way. I love those comics. If you don't know those comics, Ms. Marvel is Kamala Khan. She is a Pakistani-American teenager living in New Jersey, in Jersey City, who has basically like stretching, body morphing powers, kind of like Spider-Man. She is a teenager who is enthralled to the world of superheroes around her. She idolizes Captain Marvel, and that's why she takes her name sort of from Captain Marvel as a derivation. Also, like Spider-Man, she has her own sort of small pocket of the universe. Just like Peter Parker is a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, the Ms. Marvel comics take place very much in her neighborhood in Jersey City. The sort of thing with this being a series that I do like is that because it is that small scale part of the universe, I think it could work quite nicely as a sort of teen show with big production values, but there's very much about her day-to-day life and kind of having to wrestle the superhero stuff with her day-to-day life and how her identity as an American teenager and also as a superhero conflicts and kind of marries with her identity as a Pakistani American. I think there's a lot that you could get into in a series that you maybe would, I don't know, if you could wrestle that as much in a film or delve as much into her day-to-day life. We've already seen with the recent Spider-Man films, Spider-Man Homecoming for me did an amazing job of settling itself in the neighborhood. And as much as I really enjoyed Far From Home this summer, there was part of me that felt a bit at pains to take Spider-Man out of that environment, which worked so well. And I think with this Ms. Marvel show, they could kind of, spend a lot of time with her in her community and fully explore the idea of a localized superhero.
What else, Ben?
I mean, I don't know a huge amount about She-Hulk or Moon Knight. I'm not as versed in those comics. From what I understand, in the most basic sense, Moon Knight is sort of Marvel's equivalent of Batman. So that'll be interesting to see how they... I like that they're doing what Marvel has always done in taking these smaller characters, that they announce it and you go, oh, cool, who is this? Who is this? And then once they kind of make these projects, you go, oh, okay, I get who this character is. I see how they fit into the universe. But yeah, intrigued to see where those...
I like the poster for WandaVision. That kind of 50s suburban thing happening. I think that looked like a really interesting idea. But there's a bigger picture, isn't it, thing that they didn't they also we won't get Disney Plus in the UK until next year. I think that's right.
Lots of people have been saying, you know, what do you do if you have, because you've got the fandom over here is just as big as in the States, right? Yeah. So what happens when it goes out on Disney Plus in the US? What are we going to tell people? They have to wait, what, 3 months, 4 months?
Yeah, at least.
Even six weeks, right? Yeah. Feels like a prohibitive amount of time to somebody. And what you don't want is anybody doing illegal downloading or streaming or any of that stuff. Are there going to be, you know, deals done in terms of ways they can show it before Disney Plus full launches? You've got to wonder how they're going to bridge that gap, right?
It's fascinating, yeah. Because you know, the stuff that comes out, Hulu is like a huge, big streaming service in the States that we haven't got here. And stuff goes out there and we have to wait for that stuff, which... But almost people probably don't even realise that, but they're going to realise it big time when Disney Plus launches.
Yeah.
It's going to be intriguing.
Was there anything else from D23?
I mean, also on the WandaVision front, there's a couple of other MCU characters who are joining that show. So you're going to have Kat Dennings, who played Darcy in the first two Thor movies. If you don't remember, she's the one who goes, meow, meow, when the hammer flies through the air.
Oh, yeah.
She's the sort of like...
It's like she was here.
Yeah, meow, meow. She's the sort of, snarky, kind of spiky intern sort of character. And also Randall Park's character from Ant-Man and the Wasp, Jimmy Woo, who is a sort of policeman, is going to be in that series as well. So not only is this Disney further tying in all of the Disney Plus shows into the MCU, into the wider MCU, and saying, if you want to know the full picture of how this ties into everything else, you have to watch these shows.
Yeah.
But also, it's quite interesting. Those are two characters that you would never have picked to be involved in a project that's about Scarlet Witch and Vision. We have no idea how they fit in at the moment, but that's quite an intriguing thing to see how that's all going to tie together. Other D23 news got our first look at the Falcon and Winter Soldier series. Mm-hmm. And the big news here is that Bucky Barnes has had a haircut, which sounds like it's not big news. But if you're in that fandom, and there is one hell of a fandom for Bucky, he's back to his sort of like swankier sort of soldier haircut rather than the long, lanky, goth.
I don't like the long and the lanky.
No, nor do I. I think it's good news. Yeah, I think the shorter look is better. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What are you in, Whitesnake?
Yeah, you had too much hair before.
It was a lot of hair. It was a lot of hair. Gothy vibe.
Right.
And now he's kind of out of his gothy stage. He's been sort of fixed by Shuri and So he's slicked up for the new series. And then it was a few other bits of smaller news. There's a Monsters Inc. series coming to Disney Plus. I love Monsters Inc. And this is going to be like a workplace comedy, which just seems like the perfect fit. The Office, but Monsters Inc. Sounds great.
I'm excited about the Muppets show, which is like they said, short form, kind of almost behind the scenes reality. Unscripted. How's that going to work? Like something they call it unscripted, I think, or improvised or something?
Is it going to be like Keeping Up with the Muppets?
I hope so.
Yeah. This has got Boyd written all over it.
I'm a huge
Put him in a car with a comedian and he's like happy. Yeah.
Put me in a car with Kermit.
Boyd, any non-Disney dominating our world news?
The thing that I'm most excited about that's nothing to do with Disney or D23 is that Viola Davis is going to play Michelle Obama in a new series. This is part of the kind of Obama's getting into television development and all of that. And they've given they are kind of involved in this Showtime series, which is going to be all about first ladies in history and kind of dramatizing their lives. And in brilliant casting, Viola Davis is going to play her, and we're going to go look at kind of peek behind the scenes of the West. And all that. It's really, really exciting and brilliant. It's called First Ladies. And I just couldn't be happier about the whole idea of it, frankly.
Right.
That sounds very good.
Is that news? I'm exhausted.
So. Yeah.
I'm exhausted. Ben, did you want to say anything else?
No, I was just saying that First Lady series, are they going to do a Melania series?
Oh, hope so.
God.
I mean, yeah.
God, the question isn't who would play Melania, it's who would play fake Melania, right?
Yeah.
Right. This week's reviews. So, first up this week, it's the show that's being called The Steampunk Game of Thrones. Starring Orlando Bloom and Cara Delevingne, it's Carnival Row. The Amazon Prime video drama follows mythical creatures who have fled their battle-ravaged homeland and gathered in Victorian London, which is boiling over with violence and tensions between citizens and the immigrant population. At the same time, obviously, there is a string of unsolved murders. He has sex, he has swearing, he has bloodshed, he has shagging, Boyd. What is happening? Is this the new Game of Thrones?
No. It's got all my favourite things in terms of, swearing, shagging, a little bit of cyberpunk. A very, very basic and obvious and yet heartwarming look at, it's really about immigration and people descending into fascism when immigrants arrive in what they consider to be their place, their land. So that's the whole crux of it, really, is it's using the kind of fantasy format to look at an interesting issue. And I thought, and that element of it, I thought was kind of interesting, and I liked the way it's kind of fairly no holds barred in dealing with that, in dealing with racism and immigration and all of that. And I kind of liked the whole setting of it, and I liked the fact that it kind of went from being a bit cutesy at various moments to then being quite harsh, and there's a brothel and there's people, there's prostitution and all of that, and the way it deals with that I thought was interesting. I had a problem with Orlando Bloom, though.
Was it the accent? Can I say? It was like, I am going to solve a murder. Where is the prostitute that I can save her life?
Exactly.
He was also that like typical, like, here I am to save the fallen women.
Of course.
With my bad accent guy. Yeah.
So not only was it the kind of, it was also had a kind of that whispery kind of, kind of talking like that kind of thing. Like, I don't know, what is he trying to do? What is he trying to do? And Cara Delevingne also did an accent. She's doing like an Irish, I think, accent.
Top of the morning. Hello, I'm Cara Delevingne.
Part of me, the creative thing, and I can see, I think this is all Game of Thrones, isn't it? Game of Thrones has a very specific accent structure of trying to get the working class people to speaking in a Northern English accent, etc. And that, and other people are speaking in a RP posher British accent. I think they've seemed to have taken that as the cue to try and delineate class and race, etc., through accent use. Mm-hmm. But I think the problem is, I think in Game of Thrones they brilliantly cast most, Sean Bean was a Northern Ireland speaker. Whereas in this, we all know Cara Delevingne is a posh young woman trying to speak in this Irish accent, and we all know, how Orlando Bloom speaks. It just got in the way for me, kind of, and it kind of slightly ruined it. But I did enjoy it. Fundamentally or not, it was a very well-made, beautiful production values. I was fairly compelled by it, but
It looked great, right?
It looks great.
They have spunked. Sorry to use the word spunked at 10:19. Steam spunked at 10:19 in the morning, but they have spunked a shit ton of money on this.
Yes.
It looks phenomenal. I was surprised by how good it looked.
Yeah, I agree.
And that kind of carried me along for a while because I was like, hang on, this actually looks great. But then the talking started and not so much. And
the,
you know,
And then the talking started.
I'm here to save you. But I did, and I thought there's obviously really interesting parallels with, as you say, the like how do you descend into fascism and the kind of cyclical nature of history. But yeah, there was something about it that didn't, the storytelling I didn't think was great. Some of the storylines weren't great. The characters weren't particularly well drawn, I'd say. So I found it really hard to, there was no kind of sticking points to me where I was like, this, there's something in here that makes me want to watch the second episode. I could appreciate what it was doing, but that's kind of as far as it went for me. Ben?
Yeah, I mean, this starts with the most James Dyer info dump of all time, doesn't it? It's like a full on sort of a minute of these titles coming up on the screen of the Fey Folk are escaping to the Republic of the Berg.
I mean, except spoiler alert, we have got,
I was gonna say,
have, yeah, we've got
six,
Dark Crystal on
this
way.
From the 6 minute 24 intro to Dark Crystal.
Yeah, it's a big battle between those two, but
I kind of expected this to be a bit more fun, a bit more sprightly, because it was kind of a big mad sort of fairy world where you have fauns who have giant horns coming out of their heads and stuff, and it was quite grim and murky in a way that I kind of admired that it committed to that tone. But there was a part of me that was also like, you can have a bit more fun with this, especially when it's Cara Delevingne playing a fairy literally with a pixie haircut strangling demon dogs. It was a really brutal opening in a way that I think is purposefully setting the scene and, like you say, setting the stakes for this immigrant story. But yeah, I kind of wish it had a little bit more liveliness to it. But what I did like, especially with the first episode, it felt like a real like classic TV pilot in the sense of it did enough of setting up the world, giving you the kind of a cast of characters, but two central leads to follow, having a bit of a monster of the week story that they have to solve by the end of the episode, and then teasing what the big thing still to come for the rest of the series is. So I thought kind of structure-wise, it was a reasonably solid opening to what might come. I don't know, compared to some of the other stuff that we've watched this week, if I would, it wouldn't be at the top of my list to keep watching. But I think if you're really into this stuff, if you're really into that sort of deep, kind of quite serious fantasy that takes these things that a lot of people would think are quite silly but takes it very seriously, I think there's quite a lot that you would enjoy in it. It feels, the only real comparison to me for Game of Thrones is that it's a lot of terminology, it's a lot of families, it's a lot of different like races and stuff, and you will have to watch a big chunk of episodes before you're like, okay, these people are here and they're doing this and they're sort of related to these people in this way. And yeah, I think it'll take a while to sort of sink into that world. And in that first episode, you're watching it going, I'm just about following here who everyone is. And my favorite person in it was Tamsin Merchant, who plays Imogen Spurnrose, who was the really,
what a name.
Yeah. The really horrible posh lady, basically.
Yes.
And she seemed, she was the character that most stood out to me as quite a sort of deliciously horrible character.
I liked Piety and Absalom Breakspear, played by Indira Varma and Jared Harris, who were great, who were like kind of posh people ordering around our poor heroine.
It did slip into Downton
at
times,
which
I appreciated the Downton moments, I have to say.
Absolutely.
And I do admire any sort of show that will do that, that'll be like, we'll take some really dark fantasy stuff and then we'll have a very Downton-y element and we'll stitch it together and it'll be its own kind of nice little patchwork of all these slightly disparate things that we're going to knit together into one universe. Whether it can continue that and make it feel like a cohesive whole, we'll have to wait and see.
I think there's a certain thing, we'll get to this with Dark Crystal, which is, spoiler alert, we're reviewing later, but I do think there's a certain complacency, I think, with fantasy genre, particularly with the storytelling. Like, I almost feel like the people who create this stuff, maybe even subconsciously, think, well, fans of this genre will stick with it because they like world building, and you know, we're going to do that because, as you say, you know, opening with a kind of explanation of the different, all the different things. But I think the best, so for me, the best way of doing these things, and I'm trying to, you know, I haven't watched the first episode of Game of Thrones for years, but famously they completely redid it, didn't they? They filmed it, then they remade it, and they, it's an incredible, I still remember scenes from it being incredibly compelling. And I think it just, it told the story and explored the different, all the different elements, all the different worlds, just through the storytelling. Mm-hmm. It had that confidence about it. Whereas for me, and I think that is the difference, you know, like trying to explain everything in voiceover or whatever, or, you know,
yes,
it just feels a bit clunky and irritating for me.
Also, some of the language, right? So I was trying to like write some of it down.
Yeah.
I forsuit a ba-do-ba-do. Right. And I was like, I'm sorry, was that just, did somebody just actually speak in anything approaching English and am I meant to understand that?
Right.
And I kept rewinding it thinking, oh, if I listen to it more, it'll make sense. But I don't think, I don't even know if it's meant to.
No, right? It's like, yeah, we're making a pure drama, but in this fantasy world.
Yeah,
it's
got like pure, half fantasy, half, which at times I didn't think was completely successful, the kind of bridging of the fantasy and the reality and the, that didn't quite work for me. But yeah, the language was incredible. Whoever, who writes this?
Travis Beecham, I think.
Yeah, Travis Beecham, Renee Echevarria.
Thank you for inventing a completely new language that we all now must learn.
Yes.
Right. So Carnival Row is on Amazon Prime Video this Friday. Boyd, are they dropping the whole thing at once, or is this episodic?
I think they are dropping the whole thing at once, yes.
Okay. Next, we have the long-running Showtime drama, The Affair, which returns for its fifth and final season. Now, this was conceived as the story of what happens to two couples when the wife of one and the husband of the other has an affair, taking in a really smart device when half of each episode is shown from a different character's perspective. Now, this season has a particularly big challenge, as not only is the series now without Alison, played by Ruth Wilson, but also Joshua Jackson, who played her husband Cole. So the whole central conceit has kind of disappeared. Not only that, but this season has a significant time jump involved and introduces three-part episodes which tell three different characters' perspectives, but not even from the same year, never mind the same incident. Now, I was super suspicious going into this. So I love The Affair and have always loved The Affair. There was one kind of dip in season three. Season four, I've talked about on this podcast before, totally brought it back to like being bang on quality. I've watched the first three episodes of this season and it kind of works. And I don't know why, like it's properly spun me out because I was convinced. I was like, how can you have The Affair without half of the people who are involved with having the affair? The whole thing is about that affair and the consequences. Two of them have fucked off. And by the way, I am in full mourning for Joshua Jackson, who will forever be Pacey, and he bought Joey a wall, and don't even get me started about how he's the blueprint for all of my romantic relationships and toxic feelings towards men. But so his loss is massive. I think Ruth Wilson as Alison was just brilliant, but that central dynamic, which was about the tensions between these two marriages and these two people, these four people have been brought into each other's orbits by this one affair and the kind of ripple effect of that over, I think, 8 years. However, it does kind of work. So it picks up everyone who hasn't seen the end of season three and kind of wants to watch it, then stop listening now because we will be talking about stuff in terms of the initial plot points for the season, which are that Helen's partner Vic was dying at the end of last season. That kind of picks up here. And Noah has a film being made about his book, which is just one of the best things. Brilliant. There is the guy who wants to adapt it and is playing him is just the most brilliantly captured dickhead film guy you have ever seen. There's an amazing scene in a restaurant where you're just like, you are every like bad producer and film star I have ever met. He's so arrogant and smug and just, and not even a real person fundamentally. He's made of paper, basically. The whole thing which this show has had going for it from the beginning is kind of real authenticity about relationships and about people. The central conceit of the fact that people's accounts of the way things go down are not kind of consistent or 100% true still massively works and is still super compelling. And there is this time jump involved, which I don't want to say too much about because I don't want to give a spoiler, but essentially it goes into the future, which again feels like it shouldn't work, but it really, really does. So as I say, I'm three episodes in and I'm kind of hooked again already. They've got a lot of work to do, I think, in one season because of what they've set up and how they, I don't even know how they're going to kind of bring it to a close. But all of those notes that you had in there initially are still all there. Ben, What did you think of this?
I had never watched an episode of The Affair, and let me tell you, the 4-minute recap of the last four seasons.
Oh yeah, talking about recaps.
Was the most dramatic roller coaster I've ever been on. It was crazy. It was like, oh, he's got a nice life, she's got a nice life. Oh, they're having an affair, but now they've split up and now they're with different people and now that person's died and then, but this one's having their baby, but he's also dying. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. It was a lot to take in.
It's a lot, right?
It's a lot to take in. But I enjoyed it. I watched the first episode and I really enjoyed Dominic West basically playing the worst man. This is a TV show of the worst men.
Yes,
and the long-suffering women who have to put up with them. So Dominic West as well playing into that McNulty vein for me is this sort of sad sack, like awful dude, but who's also kind of handsome and he knows it and he knows he can get away with stuff. Very much playing in that vein.
He's such a prick.
That scene, like you said, in the restaurant where he's talking to this guy who wants to adapt his book about the affair, was just like two awful men just having an amazingly awful conversation. And you could really feel the joy in the writing of kind of picking apart these two men's flaws. The person I most liked in this was Helen. The wife, because she is so over his shit.
Yeah.
And that is incredible. There are some really sort of emotionally kind of, a few scenes where she's in a very emotional place and she just doesn't care anymore. She's going to read him to filth.
Read him to filth?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I've never heard that phrase. Is that a modern young people's phrase?
Is that a Lizzo thing?
It's probably a RuPaul's Drag Race thing.
Wow! References are so different to what we used to.
I'm sorry, James.
Yeah. Read him to filth. When you're back, I am going to read you to filth.
I feel like you do that on a weekly basis on this podcast.
Read him to filth. This is amazing.
Who's reading who to filth again?
Helen.
Oh, yeah.
Dominic West.
She absolutely does, yeah.
So I really enjoyed her ripping into him, not knowing the context of anything that's going on. I'll sort of dance around this a bit, but when the future time shift came in, I was like, this is a sci-fi show now, and that makes me automatically enjoy it more.
It's confusing.
There was a bit with like a weird sort of hologram thing, and it kind of comes out of nowhere, and I was just like,
Some of that future stuff isn't terribly convincing. It's a bit like Back to the Future 2, right? They're on hoverboards. I mean, it's quite a dystopian look, which I think isn't giving too much away, bearing in mind where the fucking planet is right now. Mm-hmm. I found that quite sobering.
I thought it was incredibly bold and brave just to go for it. We're going to do this. We're going to have an element of the show. I think everyone knows that Anna Paquin's in it, playing this key character. And it's all about the ramifications, isn't it, of what happens in the past.
That's how they've kept the consequences.
Exactly, yeah, it's all about the consequences. So I just thought it was like, whoa, I mean, you're really going for it. And I'm fascinated. I think it makes a whole new level of intrigue, and I'm absolutely fascinated by it. I thought that, again, to start with that first scene within the restaurant with these two absolute fuckwits, Clash Bang played the Hollywood A-list star, new Dracula, so he'll be in Dracula coming soon, the Stephen Moffat, Mark Gatiss version of Dracula, and he was brilliant.
Yes.
So I'm now like, oh, well, he is going to be a fantastic as Dracula, this kind of slimy, horrible, creepy twat. And the fact that Dominic West is eyeing up these young women in the other side of this diner was so brilliantly done. It was just a brilliantly modulated, very beautifully observed scene. All the way through the rest of the first few episodes, like every single scene, this has always been a show at its best, I think. And I thought it was so interesting in the recap. So in the recap, they missed out most of season three, the terrible season three.
But also something is very interesting about that recap, which is in season four, as everybody knows, if you haven't seen it for some reason, you've been living in a fucking cave, then stop listening right now, because Alison dies, right? Yeah. It's very public. Yeah. She was written out, she died, but you didn't know if it was suicide or if it was murder. There were two perspectives shown, actually both Alison's, two versions of what happened. However, in the recap, only one version is shown, and in that version, it's Ben murdering her.
Right, you're
which
right.
Which I thought was fascinating.
That is fascinating.
Is this the first time it's kind of canonical that like that was the official truth.
Well, that's the only version of the truth we're being shown gone into this, because there's no such thing as canonical in the affair, really. You're only ever given different versions.
It's unreliable narrators. It's all about unreliable narrators. But I thought that was fascinating. They just missed out a whole season, practically.
What happened to that shit French woman? Oh, I don't know. She went back to France.
I thought that was so amazing that they did that. And then what it's always done brilliantly is, shown you, there's a great scene where Dominic West is kind of coming in to rescue Maura Tierney, and by putting the bins out at her home, he like plants himself. I'm arriving now. I'm going to sort your life out. And she just won't have it. And that's a great, great moment.
It was the ultimate chefty badge moment. she has cried herself to sleep because of a bad thing that's happened. And then she wakes up and he comes in and he's like, I cleaned the house for you. And I was like,
now I'm putting out the bins. Because that's what I do, because I'm a man.
And this is the moment where Terry would say, do you want a fucking chufty badge?
I'm glad he's as brilliantly awful. And I'll tell you, that's the only thing I missed about Joshua Jackson, who played Cole, is Cole was the good guy at the heart of the show. And he was the kind of thing that not all guys were dicks, because Noah, right, by the way, barely mentioned Alison at all. She was the great love of his life, and he clearly never thinks about the fact that she's dead. He's like, whatever. I've got a new girlfriend and she's really hot, and so I don't really care. I really enjoyed him being the male kind of good moral centre of the show, and him not being there, I think there's something about that, because also Vic is the moral centre of the show as well, and without them you're just left with the bad guys. But having watched the first three episodes, it's cracking.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, it's a great show.
So, The Affair, it's on tonight at 9 o'clock. It's Tuesday on Sky Atlantic and Now TV. Finally, and with the most hype this week, we have the show that's being called The Puppet Game of Thrones, Netflix's very hotly anticipated fantasy prequel, Dark Crystal: The Age of Resistance, which comes with a remarkable voice cast across the Gelflings and the Skeksis. I feel like James would be proud of me right now, including Taron Egerton, Anya Taylor-Joy, Helena Bonham Carter, Simon Pegg, a raft of incredible talent. Ben, as the James protégé stand-in this week, what did you make of this? Was it more than a hit of nostalgia? And does it do justice to Jim Henson's legacy?
I really enjoyed this. I'd actually only seen, I watched the Dark Crystal film on Friday for the first time. I'd never seen it before. It was great. It was so good. It really reminded me of a sort of Studio Ghibli project, but puppety, in that it's that kind of quite eccentric fantasy, but it's also an ecological parable, and that whole thing about it's a world that needs harmony and they create that harmony. This plunges us 1,000 years before that. So it's a long, long ago prequel. There are a couple of characters that cross over. I would kind of recommend, if you have an extra hour and a half, because the film's only 90 minutes long, watch the film first. But I really liked the first episode of this. It was great. And I just love that who else but Netflix is going to pour the sheer amount of money to make the most ambitious puppet series ever made and do 10 hours of puppet fantasy. It kind of boggles my mind that it exists at all, let alone the fact that I just think it was a really confident opening episode. And I love that so much of it is about enjoying the craft of the puppetry, but at the same time, I thought it told a really compelling story and set up a really intriguing world and did what you'd hope it would do in expanding the world of the film without making it feel too bloated. There is a big info dump at the beginning, and considering
six
the film
minutes.
Yeah, a really big info dump.
And 24 seconds, I counted.
I think the show then follows that up with doing what Game of Thrones did, in that it's like, here's a bunch of information, but now we're going to tell you it through the characters and through the settings and how the characters interact with these settings. And you're like, okay, so these people are here. These Gelflings are the fancy Gelflings in the castle. These Gelflings are the slightly more elfy ones, and they're underground, and they're more connected to the world of Thra. And so I think it was telling that story. It gave you a bunch of information to give you a bit of a head start, but it wasn't just like, there's your starting point and we're off. It was like, here's your sort of cheat sheet, but you're also going to slowly learn about how that world works through the telling of the story. Yeah, what did you guys think?
I was disappointed that James wasn't here just to talk us through the character name, Skeksil, Skeklach, Skekung, Skekayuk. You know, he'd have loved that opportunity. I felt like the info dump at the beginning, the 6-minute voiceover info dump should have been narrated by James Dyer, really.
There would have been a 7-minute, 24-second info dump preamble before this segment, which James would have done.
So, in all honesty, I got slightly distracted by a few things. First of all, that has got this incredible voice cast of every single character, from the major to the minor, is voiced by someone incredibly famous. Eddie Izzard, Helena Bonham Carter, Toby Jones, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Lena Headey. And so I kept kind of having my list of all these people up so I could work out who was playing who, partly distracting myself. Then I got weirdly distracted halfway through. I became obsessed by the fact that the Skeksis, who are the evil people secretly running things, are these hook-nosed, very Semitic-looking, I say this as a person of the Jewish persuasion, it's kind of, you know, this kind of alien clan of this race of very hook-nosed creatures. I just couldn't get that out of my mind, and I became obsessed with it. And obviously, it's no one's fault, and I'm not being that, you know, I'm not being woke and saying, oh, someone's not really noticing how racist these rather Semitic-looking race of horrible, nasty people are. But it just kind of I became obsessed with it. And once you think about it, honestly, you can't
shake
it off.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. But I'm not saying I'm not blaming anyone. It just occurred to me halfway through that this is a race of people secretly running everything, and they really, really are very hook-nosed. But so I tweeted about this last night. Someone tweeted me saying, actually, the mystics, who are also good, are also nasally endowed, heavily nasally endowed. And they are, but not quite to the same extent. Once you get over all of that, it is fascinating to watch the combination of these puppets, which are still, because they're still puppets.
Yes.
And they still can't really move their lips properly. And they can't really have many different facial expressions. With the incredible production values of the CGI and the huge sets and the incredible kind of settings and all of that. It's just a weird viewing experience for me.
Did you find it beautiful? I found it, something about it, beautiful and reassuring. I think in an age of, you know, our favourite animations being made into live action and everything becoming so lifelike and reality-like, that actually there was something comforting about the puppets being puppets. I mean, it looked amazing. Thra just looked absolutely, the scope and scale, it looked absolutely fucking epic. But there was something about the puppets being puppets that I just thought worked absolutely fantastically.
Yeah, you just kind of go with it, And I agree, By the end of the first episode, I did enjoy it loads more than I expected. I was slightly terrified by the whole prospect of it because I thought it looked stupid. But it doesn't. Yeah, it somehow works. Yeah, it's really weird.
Skeksis do well. You like this, Skeksis?
We've been joined by Chris Hewitt.
Hello, everyone.
Came in to do that impression.
Yes.
Thank God.
Summoned by the dark crystal of truth, were I?
Yeah, I like this too. Two thumbs up.
You haven't
watched it. You haven't watched
it. I have seen it.
Did you?
I hosted a Q&A with
the
casting creators and Louis Leterrier the other day. In fact, Louis Leterrier is a guest on this week's, what's it called? Empire Podcast.
Never heard of it.
You should check it out.
Last.
You check it out. Anyway, I just came in to wrap you guys up.
And then we're not done. But you're here.
It's good.
But I'll tell you what else I enjoyed. There was genuine kind of terror and a bit of horror-y elements and real fear, but also real notes of like sweetness. And I enjoyed the tone and the fact that it felt very adult as well.
Yeah, at the end, they kind of suck the life, the Semitic race sucks the life out of the lovely, normal-nosed people. And it was quite horrific,
I felt genuinely a bit sad at that moment.
Aww.
Yeah, because you go into this and the first sort of, I don't know, half an hour, 40 minutes, you're just so swept up by the puppetry and the world and like, this exists, isn't that crazy? God, I can't believe Netflix put so much money to make this, but I'm glad they did. And then, the final few minutes made me realise how hooked into the characters and story I was, that I felt a bit gutted that a bad thing happened.
Yeah.
Also, I'm here for the Matriarchs.
Yes, the Matriarchs.
Very here for the Matriarchs. Yeah. Chris, I bet you're here for the Matriarchs.
I was very, very here for the Matriarchs. I it's really interesting because two of the three main characters are female Gelflings. And I was talking to Louise Gold, who's one of the puppeteers on the show. He's an amazing, amazing woman who was one of the original puppeteers on The Dark Crystal and on The Muppet Show as well. Just stories coming out of her everywhere. Just loads and loads of great stories. But she was saying that Lisa Henson, who is obviously Jim Henson's daughter, who is the CEO now of the Henson Company, which, you know, we're based literally just around the corner from where we are now. That's where they started up. There's still a block of flats that has the Henson Company logo in their windows. she was saying that she wanted to place a great emphasis on having female puppeteers and having a female side to the storytelling as well. So it doesn't just focus on Taron Egerton as Rhiannon, it also focuses on Natalie Emanuel as Deet and Anya Taylor-Joy as Bria. I thought this was really, really great. There was hot puppet kissing as well at one point.
Yes.
Got a little bit sexy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there going to be hot puppet sexy?
Is there going to be hot puppet sex later on, or is that going too far?
There's going to be a full Team America sequence in episode 10, I think.
I mean, these are characters that literally have people's hands inside them at all times. So you would imagine that it gets a bit hot.
Isn't it an orgy then, technically?
Technically, it is.
Fucking hell.
One of the great characters is Pamela Hand. She comes into it later on.
Pamela Hand, Jimmy the Fist. sorry.
She's gone there.
See, this was all right until Christopher though. This was all good. Right, so are we saying that Dark Crystal is the puppet Game of Thrones?
Kind of almost maybe, yeah. I mean,
sure, the Game of Thrones is the real life Dark Crystal.
Wow. Oh, yeah, that's a good point, yeah. Yeah,
I think Jim Henson got there first, guys.
Live action. Yeah. Oh,
yeah, not
know.
Real life. The Game of Thrones is not real life. I misspoke. Live action is actually the phrase I was looking for.
Oh, God. Okay, so.
This is why I don't do the pilot podcast. Yeah.
Anarchy, chaos, puppet fisting, we have everything. Dark Crystal is on Netflix this Friday, right, Boyd?
Yes, correct.
Are they dropping the whole thing?
They bloody well are, yeah.
Get on it this Friday. And that is it for another Pilot TV podcast.
Can we talk Blue Bloods?
No.
Damn it.
Still on.
Until next week, do come and talk to us on Twitter, Terry_White, at Boyd Hilton, at Ben S. Ben Bon. Ben S. Travis.
Skeksis Travis.
Ben S. Travis. And Chris, chuck yours in while you're here.
I'm at Chris Hewitt. If you don't follow me already, what the hell are you doing?
Please drop 5 of your best stars on the iTunes reviews page, as it really does help us. And join us next week when things will be back to normal, as Daddy will be home.
Well, excellent. I'm back from America. Yeah, I've been running with the customs. Hello. Isn't it?
That's my James.
The bell ends back,
what
baby.
A James.
Pilot out.